Tanta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Four Princes, Henry VIII, Francis I, Charles V, Suleiman the Magnificent, and the Obsessions That Forged Modern Europe, by John Julius Norwich, narrated by Julian Elfer. Preface. Bluff King Hal was full of beans. He married half a dozen queens. For three called Kate, they cried the banns, and one called Jane, and a couple of Annes. I learned those lines, and the several stanzas that followed them, when I was about 4 years old. They came from a wonderful book called Kings and Queens, by Herbert and Eleanor Fargen, in which each spread bore on the left a full-colour picture of each monarch in turn, and on the right a humorous verse. My mother bought two copies, cut them up, and pasted the lot onto a large screen in the nursery. Thus I was almost literally brought up with them, and cannot remember a time when I didn't recognise them all, as well as the order in which they came. Since we started with William the Conqueror, and there were six kings or queens to a column, Henry VIII was the second one down in the fourth. I felt I knew him well. Getting to know Francis I took me a bit longer. The Fargens, alas, never got around to doing for French history what they had done for English, and in those pre-war days primary historical education in England was almost unbelievably blinkered. Never were we told what was going on in Europe, except on those occasions when we won a battle abroad like Agincourt or Blenheim. We knew nothing about Italy, where the British hardly ever fought a battle before the 20th century. That of Maida, which gave its name to Maida Vale, in 1806 is the only one I can think of offhand, and we were certainly never told about that, and only a very little about Spain, principally the story of the Armada. As for the Byzantine Empire, which lasted over 1,000 years and dominated the civilized world for centuries, I think I had barely heard of it before I went to Oxford. Francis, anyway, had to wait until we settled in France, when my parents and I always stopped at Fontainebleau on our way to the south, and I went on a bicycle tour among the chateaux of the Loire. Charles V was still more of a challenge. During my formative years, I suppose we thought of him, when we thought of him at all, as a German. And since we were at war with Germany, we would have cold-shouldered him on principle. Of course, he was also Spanish, but then we weren't terribly keen on Spain either. Nor, it must be said, did we like the look of him, with that dreadful Habsburg jaw and chin. Besides, he was against Martin Luther, on whom most Anglican schools were rather keen. I obviously learned a certain amount about him when I was writing about the papacy. He had little imagination, I wrote, and no ideas of his own, which now strikes me as a bit unfair. He was certainly a lot more intelligent than his majestically boring son, Philip II. I suspect in any case that he still remained a somewhat shadowy figure in my mind, until I came to tackle the book that you now hold in your hands. And so to Suleiman the Magnificent. Of course, he was always an outsider. But did those English preparatory and public schools ever mention the Ottoman Empire? Did they ever tell us about the Battle of Mohacs, one of the greatest military encounters that Central Europe has ever seen? Or of how the Turks twice reached the gates of Vienna, and, surely most surprising of all, of how in 1543 they besieged and plundered the city of Nice, of all places, enthusiastically supported by a French army? Of course they didn't. I think I first came to know Suleiman, insofar as I know him at all, since none but his very few intimates knew him well, in the 1970s, when I made a series of 6 films for the BBC about the antiquities of Turkey, the last of the series being devoted to the Ottomans. Biographies of him are in short supply. Anthony Bridge, a former dean of Guildford, produced one, but the definitive biography in English remains to be written, and the task won't be easy. Since Kemal Atatürk introduced the Latin alphabet in 1928, the old Arabic alphabet has not even been taught in Turkish schools. The result is that no one in Turkey, apart from a few scholars, can read any book published before that date. Henry, Francis, Charles, and Suleiman. When did I begin to see them as the single phenomenon that they collectively were, and the possible subject of a book of their own? First, I think, 10 or 12 years ago, when I was writing about the Mediterranean. But the idea was then a pretty nebulous one, and I had other things on my mind. It began to assume a rough shape only 5 years later when, although I was principally concerned with the popes, it struck me once again what giants those 4 men had been, how completely they had overshadowed their predecessors and successors, and finally, how deep was the imprint they left on the century in which they lived. There was, I felt reasonably sure, a book there somewhere. I only hope this is it. John Julius Norwich, April 2016. Author's note. Far too much, I believe, is sacrificed on the altar of consistency. The attentive reader will notice several inconsistencies in these pages. French dukes, for example, may sometimes be duc and sometimes duke. Foreign names are sometimes anglicized, Francis for François, for example, and sometimes not. It would be ridiculous to translate Jacques into James or Ivan into John. In every case, I have been guided by what sounds right to my ear, and will, I hope, sound right to the reader. 1. The Hollow of Their Hands. The beginning of the 16th century was an exciting time to be alive. The feudal Europe of the Middle Ages was changing fast into a cluster of national states. The unity of Western Christendom was endangered more than it had ever been before, and was indeed to be lost before the century had run a quarter of its course. The Ottoman Turks, thanks to a succession of able and ambitious sultans, were surging westward on all fronts. The discovery of the New World had brought fabulous wealth to Spain and Portugal, causing vast disruption to the traditional European economy. And in no other period was the entire continent overshadowed by four such giants, all born in a single decade, the 10 years between 1491 and 1500. They were, in order of age, King Henry VIII of England, King Francis I of France, the Ottoman Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, and the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. Sometimes friends, more often enemies, always rivals, the four of them together held Europe in the hollow of their hands. The most colourful was Francis. When he was born, in Cognac, on the 12th of September, 1494, he seemed a long way from the throne. His father Charles, Count of Angoulême, was only the first cousin of the reigning king, the already ailing Louis XII, who, in his determination to produce a male heir, married three wives, the last being Henry VIII's younger sister, Mary Tudor. The French were shocked that this ravishingly beautiful 18-year-old, with luscious golden hair to her waist, should be handed over to a gouty and toothless old dotard three times her age. But Mary bore her fate philosophically, knowing that it could not possibly last very long. And she was right. After their wedding night on the 9th of October, her battered bridegroom boasted to all who would listen that he had performed marvels, but nobody believed him. As he watched Francis jousting during the wedding celebrations, he was heard to murmur, "Ce grand jeune homme, il va tout gâcher." That big lad, he'll ruin everything. He died on New Year's Day, 1515, less than 3 months after the marriage, exhausted, it was generally believed, by his exertions in the bedchamber. Mary found it hard to disguise her relief. She had long been passionately in love with Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, and was now at last free to marry him, which she lost no time in doing, despite a warning by two English priests in Paris that he regularly cast spells and trafficked with the devil. Francis, meanwhile, assumed the throne. In the previous year he had married King Louis's daughter, Claude, and on the 25th of January 1515 in Reims Cathedral he was crowned and anointed the 57th King of France. His new subjects were delighted. The country had recently suffered a whole series of drab and sickly monarchs. Here now was a magnificent figure of a man, bursting with youthful energy. A Welshman who saw him at the Field of the Cloth of Gold in 1520 describes him as being 6 feet tall, the nape of his neck unusually broad, his hair brown, smooth and neatly combed, his beard, of 3 months' growth, darker in colour, his eyes hazel and somewhat bloodshot, and his complexion the colour of watery milk. His buttocks and thighs were muscular, but his lower legs were thin and bandy. He was not, it must be said, strictly handsome. His perfectly enormous nose earned him the nickname of Le Roi Grand Nez, but he made up for it with his grace and elegance, and with the multicoloured silks and velvets which left his courtiers dazzled. He had beautiful manners and irresistible charm. He loved conversation and could discuss any subject relating to the arts and sciences, not so much because he had studied them all deeply, as because of his quite extraordinary memory. It seemed that he remembered everything that he ever read or was ever told. Always laughing, it was clear that he loved every moment of his kingship, revelling in all the pleasures that it could provide, hunting, feasting, jousting, and above all, the ready availability of any number of beautiful women. He was quintessentially a man of the Renaissance, with a passion for art and a degree of wealth that enabled him to indulge it to the full. Before long, he was celebrated as one of the greatest patrons of his age. He brought Leonardo da Vinci from Italy, installing him in splendid apartments at Amboise, where the great man lived till his death. At various times he also welcomed Andrea del Sarto, Rosso Fiorentino, known to the French as Maître Roux, and countless other Italian painters, sculptors and decorators, including Benvenuto Cellini, who carved the medallion from which Titian was later to paint his famous portrait. Of them all, however, his favourite was Francesco Primaticcio, whom he employed, particularly at Fontainebleau, with spectacular success. Fontainebleau was always his favourite residence. It was indeed his home, insofar as he had one. But Francis was restless by nature, and he was also a compulsive builder. He largely reconstructed the Château of Amboise and Blois and created Chambord, that most magnificent of all hunting boxes, quite possibly with the help of Leonardo himself. In all of them, again and again, we see his emblem, the salamander, often surrounded by flames. Its legendary attribute of being impervious to fire made it the perfect symbol of endurance. In Paris itself, he transformed the Louvre from a medieval fortress into a vast Renaissance palace and personally financed the new Hôtel de Ville in order to have full control over its design. Then there was literature. Francis was a dedicated man of letters, with a reverence for books which he had inherited from his mother, Louise of Savoy. She had taught him fluent Italian and Spanish. His weak spot was Latin, with which he was never entirely at ease. He was a personal friend of François Rabelais, for whose unforgettable giant Pantagruel he is said to have provided the inspiration. His philosophy, according to Rabelais, was rooted in a certain gaiety of mind pickled in the scorn of fortuitous things, whatever that may mean. To be his chief librarian, he appointed Guillaume Boudet, who, at the age of 23, had renounced a life of debauchery and pleasure to become the greatest French scholar of the day, and he employed special agents all over North Italy to seek out manuscripts and the relatively new printed books, just as others were seeking out paintings, sculptures, and objets d'art. In 1537 he signed a decree known as the Ordonnance de Montpellier, providing that one copy of every book published or sold in France should be lodged in the Royal Library, a right that is now enjoyed by the Bibliothèque Nationale, of which that library formed the nucleus. At the time of his death it was to contain over 3,000 volumes, many of them looted from the Sforza Library in Milan, and was open to any scholar who wished to use it. Another decree, the Ordonnance de Villers-Cotterêts of 1539, made French, rather than Latin, the official language of the country, and instituted a register of births, marriages, and deaths in every parish. To be chancellor of a new college for Greek, Latin, and Hebrew, Francis invited the greatest humanist of his day, Erasmus of Rotterdam, and Boudet wrote a letter urging him to accept the invitation. "This monarch," he wrote, "is not only a Frank, which is in itself a glorious title, he is also Francis, a name borne by a king for the first time and, one can prophesy, predestined for great things. He is educated in letters, which is unusual with our kings, and also possesses a natural eloquence, wit, tact, and an easy, pleasant manner. Nature, in short, has endowed him with the rarest gifts of body and mind. He likes to admire and to praise princes of old who have distinguished themselves by their lofty intellects and brilliant deeds, and he is fortunate to have as much wealth as any king in the world, which he gives more liberally than anyone." Erasmus, though flattered and tempted, did not allow himself to be persuaded. The fact that he was receiving a regular pension from the emperor may have had something to do with it. The invitation was declined and the project shelved. Only a little more successful was the king's short-lived Greek college in Milan. His great educational triumph, on the other hand, came in 1529 when, to the fury of the Sorbonne, he founded the Collège des Lecteurs Royaux, the future Collège de France. In short, it seems hardly too much to say that modern French culture and all it stands for was virtually originated by Francis I. He was the personification of the Renaissance. Hunting and fighting were no longer enough for a nobleman. Education was now required as well. Before him, the French world was still essentially Gothic, obsessed by war. During his reign, war might still be important. Francis himself was a fearless fighter on the battlefield and loved nothing more than staging mock battles for the amusement of his friends. A particularly ambitious one took place at Amboise in 1518, when 600 men led by the king and the Duc d'Alençon defended a model town against an equal number led by the Dukes of Bourbon and Vendôme. "It was the finest battle ever seen," wrote the young Maréchal de Fleuranges, "and the nearest to real warfare, but the entertainment did not please everyone, for some were killed and others frightened." But the art of elegant living was more important still. In Baldassare Castiglione's Book of the Courtier, which was begun in 1508, though it was not published until 20 years later, it is Francis who is seen as the great white hope who brings civilization to France at last. "I believe," says Count Ludovico, "that for all of us the true and principal adornment of the mind is letters, although the French, I know, recognize only the nobility of arms and think nothing of all the rest. And so they not only do not appreciate learning, but detest it, regarding men of letters as basely inferior and thinking it a great insult to call anyone a scholar." But the Magnifico Giuliano replies, "You are right in saying that this error has prevailed among the French for a long time now. But if good fortune has it that Monseigneur d'Angoulême, as it is hoped, succeeds to the throne, then I believe that, just as the glory of arms flourishes and shines in France, so also with the greatest brilliance must that of letters. For when I was at the court not long ago, I set eyes on this prince, and among other things I was told that he greatly loved and esteemed learning and respected all men of letters, and that he condemned the French themselves for being so hostile to this profession." The Magnifico, as we know, was not disappointed, and it is no surprise that, of all their kings, it is Francis whom, with Henry IV, the French most love today. They love him for his swagger and his braggadocio, for his courage in war and his prowess in the bedchamber, for the colour and opulence with which he surrounded himself, and for the whole new civilization that he left behind. They pass over with a shrug his financial recklessness, which by June 1517 had led him into a debt roughly equal to his annual income. In the following year he paid Henry VIII 600,000 gold écus for the return of Tournai, which was French anyway. The imperial election meant the throwing away of another 400,000, while the field of the cloth of gold could not have cost him less than 200,000 livres tournois. Gold écus were actual coins, livres tournois money of account. It's no good even trying to give modern equivalents. There is admiration, too, for the sheer zest that he showed in his lifelong struggle with the House of Habsburg, all too easily identified in French minds with Germany, France's traditional enemy for the next 400 years. Only his increasing persecution of the Protestants, mostly, though not entirely, in the last decade of his reign, do they find harder to forgive. For the first decade, the most important woman in Francis's life was unquestionably his mother, Louise of Savoy. On two separate occasions while he was fighting in Italy, in 1515 and 1524-6, she served as regent, but even when he was at home her influence was considerable, greater by far than that of either of her daughters-in-law. Next came his sister Margaret. Beautiful, elegant, intelligent, and graceful in all her movements, to her brother she was everything that a woman should be. When she was 18 she was forced to marry the Duc d'Alençon, in theory the second nobleman in France. The marriage, however, was not a success. First, because Alençon was a laggard and adult, and second, because she was at the time passionately in love with the dashing Gaston de Foix, Duke of Nemours, known as the Thunderbolt of Italy. There were, fortunately, no children, and after Alençon's death in 1525, she married King Henry II of Navarre. Francis had two wives. His first, as we have seen, was Claude, the daughter of Louis XII and Anne of Brittany. Her name is still remembered in the Reine Claude Plum, or Greengage, and she did her duty by bearing Francis 7 children. Of their 3 sons, the first and third, Francis and Charles, both died before their father. The second, Henry, named after the King of England, was to become King Henry II. But since she was very small and strangely corpulent, with a limp and a pronounced squint, she never interested him much. For all that, she was a good, sweet-natured girl. An ambassador reported that her grace in speaking greatly made up for her want of beauty. She died in 1524, in her 25th year. The king's second wife, whom he married after 6 years of riotous bachelorhood, was Eleanor of Austria, sister of Charles V. For 3 brief years she had been the third wife of King Manuel I of Portugal. Alas, she proved to be no great improvement on her predecessor. Tall and sallow, with the jutting Habsburg chin and a curious absence of personality. A lady-in-waiting was subsequently to report that, when undressed, she was seen to have the trunk of a giantess, so long and big was her body, yet going lower she seemed a dwarf, so short were her thighs and legs. Already 4 years before her wedding to Francis, it was reported that she had grown corpulent, heavy of feature, with red patches on her face, as if she had elephantiasis. Francis largely ignored her. There were no children. She was certainly no match for her husband's regiment of mistresses. To this he apparently even tried to recruit his predecessor's wife, Queen Mary Tudor, who complained that he had been importunate with her in divers matters not to her honour. Of whom the loveliest of all was Anne d'Ailly, one of the 30 children of Guillaume d'Ailly, Sieur de Pizelleux, worse than Wolfe, in Picardy. Later, Frances was to make her Duchess d'Étampes. Well-read, highly cultured, and ravishingly beautiful, she was, as he used to say, la plus belle des savants, la plus savante des belles, the most beautiful of the scholars, the most scholarly of the beauties. Even when Francis was not on campaign, he was constantly on the move. Never, wrote a Venetian ambassador, Venice was the first state to have a fully organized diplomatic service, with resident representatives in the principal capitals. And the Republic's state archives are the most comprehensive and complete in the world. No wonder, then, that we rely so much on the Venetians for contemporary reports, such as those in this book. During the whole of my embassy was the court in the same place for 15 consecutive days. This appears still more remarkable when one considers the logistical problems involved. When the court was complete, it took no fewer than 18,000 horses to move it. When the king visited Bordeaux in 1526, stabling was ordered for 22,500 horses and mules. The baggage train normally included furniture, tapestries for warmth, and silver plate by the ton, and the finding of suitable accommodation, as may be imagined, was a constant nightmare. Often there were rooms only for the king and his ladies. Everyone else slept in shelter, often 5 or 6 miles away or under canvas. But whatever hardships they were called upon to suffer, they were always expected to be ready for the elaborate ceremonies that were staged by the major cities and towns through which they passed. In Lyon in 1515, Francis was entertained by a mechanical lion designed by Leonardo da Vinci. At Marseille in 1516, he sailed out to meet a Portuguese ship carrying a live rhinoceros, a present from King Manuel to the Pope. These royal visits, however, did not always pass without a hitch. In 1518, the captain of Brest was obliged to pay 100 gold écus following artillery accidents during the king's entry, as indemnity to the wounded and to the widows of the deceased. Appalled by the vast new wealth that was flooding from the New World into the coffers of his brother-in-law and rival the Emperor Charles V, Francis was determined that Charles should not have it all his own way. He sent several major expeditions across the Atlantic, as a result of which he was able to claim Newfoundland for France, together with the city of New Angoulême on the island of Manhattan. It was later to become a Dutch colonial settlement, named New Amsterdam after 1625. In 1664 it was conquered by the English and renamed New York. It was named by a certain Giovanni de Verrazzano, an Italian navigator sailing under the French flag, who in April 1524 became the first man since the ancient Norsemen thoroughly to explore the Atlantic coast of the New World between New Brunswick and Florida. He might have gone even further had he not in 1528 had the misfortune to be eaten by a Carib tribe on Guadalupe. In 1534 and 1535, Jacques Cartier was the first to describe the Gulf of St. Lawrence and the shores of the St. Lawrence River, but his reputation suffered greatly after the gold and diamonds that he had brought back with him were tested and found to be worthless. Meanwhile, Jean Parmentier of Dieppe, a town that later became famous for its map-making, sailed to the coasts of North and South America, West Africa, and in October 1529, the island of Sumatra. Where religion was concerned, Francis's reign coincided almost exactly with the Reformation. Initially, he had tended to sympathize with Protestantism, so long as it remained well this side of heresy, if only because by doing so he made trouble for Charles. His sister Margaret had still stronger reformist tendencies and was known, though not altogether deservedly, as la mère poule de la réforme. In 1534, he was even to send a mission to Germany to establish friendly relations with the reformers. All the time, however, he had to contend with the Sorbonne, which remained vigorously pro-Catholic, and in 1521 issued a violent condemnation of Martin Luther. In 1523 it went further still, and, shocked by the recent publication of a French version of the New Testament, even tried to ban foreign translations of the scripture altogether. But this time Francis stepped in. Its author, he pointed out, was no less than Maître Jacques Lefebvre d'Étaples, a highly respected scholar, celebrated and esteemed throughout Europe. Any objection to his works was henceforth forbidden. Despite the opposition, there is every reason to suppose that Francis might have continued to regard the new movement with sympathy, had it not been for what became known as the Affaire des Placards, a full account of which will be given in Chapter 4. Wholesale persecutions and executions began, and the country was plunged into a religious civil war which did much to poison the last years of the king's life, and was to continue till the end of the century, 50 years after his death. Oddly enough, however, while his Protestant and Catholic subjects were at daggers drawn, the most Christian king, a special title granted by the Pope, was, for the last 20 years of his reign, in extremely friendly contact with the infidel Sultan Suleiman. The friendship was, it need hardly be said, born of politics rather than religion, but it was to do severe damage to the king's reputation in the rest of Christian Europe. Like Francis, King Henry VIII of England was not born to be king. The second of Henry VII's sons, he first saw the light of day on the 28th of June 1491 at Greenwich, he grew up expecting the crown to pass to his elder brother Arthur. This is probably why we know so little about his youth. Everyone was far more interested in Arthur than they were in Henry. All we are left with is the mildly ridiculous catalogue of titles which were almost immediately bestowed on him. Constable of Dover Castle and Warden of the Cinque Ports before his second birthday, Earl Marshal of England before his third, Lieutenant of Ireland before his fourth. On the 30th to the 31st of October 1494, still aged 3, he was admitted to the Order of the Bath by his father, who commanded the Duke of Buckingham to attach a spur to his right heel before dubbing him. The next day he was proclaimed Duke of York, a month later Warden of the Scottish Marches, and on the 17th of May 1495 he received the Garter. Despite these distinctions, he enjoyed no real prominence until the 14th of November 1501, when he headed the procession which escorted his brother's young bride, the Princess Catherine, daughter of King Ferdinand of Aragon and Queen Isabella of Castile, to St. Paul's for her marriage. It was only when Arthur died of consumption in 1502, at the age of 15, leaving young Catherine a widow, that Henry found himself heir to the throne. In the following year he was formally betrothed to his sister-in-law. She was by now 17, while he was nearly 12, and in 1506, after the granting of a special papal dispensation, they were married. According to Professor Scarisbrick, she was certainly of a quality of mind and life which few queens have seriously rivalled. His childhood, both before and after his engagement, seems to have been a nightmare. According to a Spanish envoy who came to England in 1508, the 17-year-old was confined to a single room, the sole access to which was through the chamber of the king. He could go out only into a private park, and even then had always to be accompanied by one of the few officials authorized to do so. The Spaniard may, of course, have been exaggerating. He later reported that the young prince spent his days tilting at Richmond, But Arthur was a sickly boy, and his father, who had already lost 5 of his 8 children, may well have suspected that his second son might soon succeed his eldest, and must therefore be kept on a short leash. King Henry VII died on the 22nd of April, 1509. Strangely, he had made no effort to train his son and heir in the art of kingship. Thus it was that when young Henry was himself proclaimed king on the following day, he had surprisingly little idea of what to expect. This, however, did not stop him embracing his new role with tremendous, unashamed gusto, as well he might. Thanks to his father, he had inherited a throne more secure than ever it had been, a very considerable fortune, and the best-governed kingdom in Christendom. Like his French rival, he made an impressive figure, a good 6 feet in height, and always magnificently dressed. "His fingers were one mass of jewelled rings," wrote the Venetian ambassador, "and around his neck he wore a gold collar from which hung a diamond as big as a walnut. His Majesty," opined another Venetian, "is the handsomest potentate I have ever set eyes on." He was better looking than Francis, and he knew it. From the beginning, however, he was conscious of the bitter rivalry between them, and he knew, too, that he was beginning with a serious disadvantage. His forebears had been simple Welsh squires. Those of Francis had been kings since the 10th century. Soon after his accession, that same Venetian envoy reported to his government, "His Majesty came into our arbour and, addressing me in French, said, 'Talk with me a while. The King of France, is he as tall as I am?' I told him there was but little difference. He continued, 'Is he as stout?' I said he was not. And then he inquired, 'What sort of leg has he?' I replied, 'Spare,' whereupon he opened the front of his doublet, and placing his hand on his thigh, said, 'Look here, I too have a good calf to my leg.'" As a builder, Henry was no match for Francis. He tried hard enough, first with a palace at Bridewell, which subsequently became a prison, and then another at Oatlands in Surrey. Only when these were completed did he start work on Nonsuch, near Ewell, the largest and most splendid of them all, which he intended as a proclamation of Tudor wealth and power, a rival, he hoped, to Francis's Chambord. Alas, while Chambord remains as glorious as ever, of Nonsuch not one stone remains on another. Henry's only major building that still stands is St. James's Palace in London, but even if all his buildings had survived, they still could not hold a candle to what Francis achieved in Paris, Fontainebleau, and on the banks of the Loire. Both physically and intellectually, on the other hand, Henry in his youth seems to have been more than a match for the French king. He was a prodigious horseman, and when at the hunt is said to have regularly worn out 8 or 10 horses in the course of a day. He wrestled, he played tennis, he threw the javelin further than any of his court. At the jousts he was prepared to take on any knight in his kingdom. When he practised archery with the archers of his guard, he cleft the mark in the middle and surpassed them all. He was a considerable scholar too, and no mean theologian. He spoke French fluently, his Latin was very nearly as good, and thanks to Catherine, he was to pick up more than a smattering of Spanish. He enjoyed close contact with Erasmus, who kept him abreast of European culture. On clear nights he would go up onto the palace roof with Sir Thomas More to study the stars. Above all, he loved music. He regularly employed foreign as well as English musicians, among them the celebrated Dionisio Memo, sometime organist of St. Mark's in Venice. He himself played beautifully on the virginals. He was an accomplished singer and wrote several love songs, but not, alas, Greensleeves, with which he is commonly credited, but which is almost certainly Elizabethan in date, which he sang to his own accompaniment on the lute, and at least 2 masses, both in 5 parts. These came straight from the heart, since he was deeply and sincerely religious, hearing Mass at least once a day. He was, in fact, that strange combination, a Catholic and a Puritan. It was he who authorized the English Bible, ordering that a copy should be kept in every parish church, for all to read on that would. Yet he was also the first English iconoclast, replacing the crucifixes in the churches with the royal arms, while the damage he inflicted on English art and literature by his dissolution of the monasteries is beyond computation. His quarrel with the Catholic Church was not doctrinal, but essentially personal, directed against the Medici Pope Clement VII, who consistently refused to grant the annulment on which he had set his heart. By this time, Henry genuinely believed that marriage to a dead brother's wife was an offence against canon law, and that Catherine's continued failure to bear him a son, after countless miscarriages and stillbirths, was a proof of divine displeasure. Even after the establishment of the Church of England, he continued to see himself as a champion of Catholicism, always confident that he was right and the Pope was wrong, and that it was he, not Clement, who was doing God's will. Only where government was concerned did Henry betray a certain lack of self-confidence. He was content to leave most political decisions to three supremely competent advisers. They followed each other in swift succession, and each in turn wielded more power than any others during the entire Tudor dynasty. First came his wife, Catherine of Aragon, of whom there will be more to say in the next chapter. Next, Thomas Wolsey. Born in Ipswich in about 1473, Wolsey was long thought to have been the son of a local butcher, thanks probably to the unkind stories deliberately circulated about him by his enemies during his lifetime. His father is actually more likely to have been a prosperous cloth merchant. We know for a fact, however, that in 1507 he entered the service of King Henry VII, who soon afterwards appointed him royal chaplain. By 1514 he was the controlling figure in the government, and in the following year, while still in his early 40s, he became Archbishop of York and a cardinal. For some 15 years he was the most powerful man in England after the king himself. But it was all too good to last. Try as he might, Wolsey failed utterly to arrange the annulment of Henry's marriage. In consequence, he fell out of favour and was stripped of his government posts. Charges of treason were put forward, but he died, of natural causes, before he could answer them. Henry's third adviser was Thomas Cromwell. He indeed was of humble origins, the son of a blacksmith and innkeeper. From around 1516 to 1530 he was a member of Wolsey's household, and by 1529 his secretary. But that was the very year of the cardinal's downfall. Less than 12 months later, Cromwell had effectively replaced his former master in the king's favour and trust. When Henry took the most fateful step in his career, his break with Rome in order to divorce Queen Catherine and to marry Anne Boleyn, subsequently setting himself up as head of the Church of England, it was Cromwell, not Wolsey, who made it all possible. He also played a key role in the dissolution of the monasteries, which began in 1536. But he was to end his life in still worse disgrace than his predecessor. Wolsey, at least, died in his bed. In July 1540, Thomas Cromwell was beheaded on Tower Hill. In the early years of his reign, Henry was loved by his subjects, being seen as a welcome contrast to his avaricious old father. And despite the excesses and brutalities of his later life, much of his popularity endured. The 16th century was less easily shocked than we are today. Executions, usually public, were fairly frequent occurrences. Little sympathy was shown for Anne Boleyn or Catherine Howard, the two wives whom the king beheaded. They were generally believed to have been unfaithful. Indeed, in Catherine's case, wildly promiscuous. As for the divorce, everyone understood that a male heir was the only guarantee of future tranquility, and since the Pope's refusal to allow the dispensation was known to be entirely political, he did not dare to offend the Emperor Charles, who was Queen Catherine's nephew. Nobody could blame King Henry for taking the law into his own hands. He was fortunate indeed that his great matter, the putting aside of Catherine, should have coincided so neatly with the beginnings of the Reformation. It was much easier to quarrel with Rome when half of northern Europe was doing much the same thing. Doubtless because of his remarkable matrimonial history, Henry has the reputation of having been a great lover of women. In fact, he seems to have been, if anything, the reverse. Here was another field in which he could not begin to equal his rival Francis. He is known to have had two affairs. One, with Elizabeth Blunt, a lady-in-waiting to Queen Catherine, produced a son, whom Henry subsequently acknowledged and made the Duke of Richmond. The other, with Anne Boleyn's sister Mary, may also have been fruitful, but the jury is still out. The importance of Henry's affair with Mary, unfortunately, meant that he was henceforth technically related to her sister in the same degree of affinity as he was to Catherine. If the law forbade him Catherine, it also forbade him Anne. He devised a quibble to get out of the difficulty, though it satisfied few people other than himself. Of his wives, Anne is probably the only one whom he genuinely loved, though even with her he was quite often stricken with impotence, and even she ended on the block. By 1535, there is reason to believe that Henry seriously suspected her of witchcraft. What other reason could there be for impotence in a man as lusty and virile as he believed himself to be? With Anne of Cleves, he was unable to perform at all. The other four, in varying degrees, he saw primarily as potential mothers. The problem of the succession became slightly less acute with the birth to Jane Seymour in October 1537 of the future King Edward VI. But infant mortality in those days was such that two or three sons were necessary if the succession were to be even half guaranteed. Edward, in fact, was to survive for only 16 years, and, unlike Prince Arthur, had no younger brother to take his place. In Henry's eyes, it need hardly be said, princesses were no substitute. England had never had a ruling queen, apart from the 12th century Matilda, whose reign, largely spent battling with King Stephen for the crown, had been, to say the least, undistinguished. For most of his life, Charles V was by far the most powerful man in the civilized world. Born in Ghent in 1500, and consequently the youngest of our four princes, he was the grandson of the Emperor Maximilian, the son of Philip the Handsome of Austria, and Joanna the Mad of Aragon and Castile. He had inherited neither of his parents' primary attributes. His appearance was unattractive and ungainly, with the characteristically immense Habsburg chin and protruding lower lip, and he was fully aware of the fact. He used to say with a smile that he couldn't help being ugly, but that, as artists usually painted him uglier than he was, strangers on seeing him for the first time were agreeably disappointed. He suffered also from an appalling stammer. He was serious and deeply religious. One never gets the feeling that he enjoyed his monarchy in the way that Francis and Henry did. Indeed, it is doubtful whether the idea of doing so ever entered his head. Not for him were the roistering and the feasting, the glowing velvets and the brocades. At least in his youth, he ate sparingly and usually alone. An exception was a dinner Charles gave in his youth to the chapter of the Golden Fleece. Most of the knights present missed the subsequent service of Vespers, either because they were incapable or were still at table. Possibly both. And while there were obviously occasions when he was obliged to dress richly, as when Titian first painted him at the age of 33, he always appears vaguely uncomfortable. It is only in the master's third and last portrait, painted 15 years later, that he looks at ease. He is then dressed entirely in black, with the golden fleece around his neck, providing the only touch of brilliance. Apart from his religion, his life was dominated, as it had to be, by politics. A little less intelligent and a lot less cultivated than Henry or Francis, he was far more industrious than either. Unlike them, he had no real interest in literature. Most serious books were still written in Latin, and his mastery of the language, like that of Francis, was always surprisingly weak. As a boy, he had devoured the memoir of Olivier de la Marche, a 15th-century member of the Burgundian court, whose surprisingly salacious tales of chivalry and derring-do on the part of former dukes had enjoyed immense success in court circles. Later in his life, what little spare time he possessed was devoted to music, for which he had a lifelong passion. He played the spinet, the flute, and several other instruments. He sang, we are told, like an angel. His inheritance was greater than that of any European ruler in history. It began with the Burgundian Low Countries, which had come to him through his grandmother, Mary of Burgundy, and where he spent his childhood. Since both his parents had left for Spain when he was still a baby, he was put under the guardianship of Margaret of York, the childless widow of Duke Charles the Bold of Burgundy, and the sister of the English kings Edward IV and Richard III. After her death in 1503, his upbringing was entrusted to his father's sister Margaret of Austria, also childless after two marriages, who ruled as regent until, at 15, he took over the reins himself. His father Philip was long dead. His mother Joanna, though already hopelessly insane, was still technically Queen of Castile, with her father, Ferdinand of Aragon, acting as regent. But shortly after Ferdinand's death in 1516, rumoured to have been due to dropsy, brought on by an aphrodisiac given him by his second wife, Germaine of Foix, she was a niece of Louis XII. According to Prudencio de Sandoval, Bishop of Pamplona, she also taught the hitherto abstemious Spanish grandees the joys of the table, which they enjoyed so much that several of them died in consequence. In the hope of begetting a child, Charles was proclaimed king not only of Aragon and Castile, but also of Naples, Sicily, and Sardinia. Then, in January 1519, his grandfather Maximilian died of a massive stroke at the age of 59. Since the empire remained elective, the succession of his grandson was by no means a foregone conclusion. Charles, however, was determined to secure it at any cost, if only to prevent it from falling into the hands of Francis, who was initially supported by the reigning Pope Leo X. From his point of view, the election of Francis would have been a catastrophe. It would have spelt the end of his hopes of regaining Burgundy, and might even have called into question the hereditary Habsburg lands in Germany and Austria. Fortunately for Charles, however, the German electors hated the idea of a French emperor almost as much as he did himself. The Fuggers, that hugely rich and influential banking family from Augsburg, lined as many pockets as was necessary, and Charles was elected, unanimously, Holy Roman Emperor. The whole operation probably cost him rather more than 500,000 gold florins. He was to remain in debt for the rest of his life. Maximilian had never thought much of him. If it was not for the boy's love of hunting, he used to say, he would have questioned his parentage. He made no secret of the fact that he vastly preferred Charles's younger brother Ferdinand, who, with his easy ways, charm and gregariousness, was by a long way the more attractive of the two. He was also much better looking. It may well be, indeed, that his grandfather's disapproval lay at the root of the difficulties that Charles always had with his German subjects, in whose language he was never really happy. His first language had been French, and since his childhood he had also spoken fluent Flemish, though this was not at the time considered a polite language. When he first went to Spain at the age of 17 to claim his inheritance, he still possessed not a word of Spanish, though it was rapidly to become his second tongue. The divine language, he called it, and he used it always when speaking or writing to his wife and children, though he wrote to his brother's family in French. He is frequently quoted as saying that he spoke French to his friends, German to his horses, Italian to his mistresses, and Spanish to God. It is only fair, however, to add that much the same remark has also been attributed to Frederick the Great, though this seems highly unlikely. Mistresses were not Frederick's forte. Strange as it may seem, Charles had spent all his early youth in Flanders. Never once had he visited the old Habsburg lands. Now, in addition to his already vast domains, there devolved on him with his election all the old patrimony of the Habsburgs, comprising most of modern Austria, Germany, and Switzerland. Milan, Bohemia, and Western Hungary were to follow a little later. For a man whom most people believed, mistakenly as it turned out, to be of modest talents and frankly mediocre abilities, here was an inheritance indeed. Sensibly enough, he soon decided to entrust the central European part of the empire to his brother the Archduke Ferdinand, despite the fact that the Archduke had been born and brought up in Spain and never set foot in the old empire until his 18th year. In 1521 he married Ferdinand to Anne, the sister of King Louis of Hungary, and in the following year Louis married his and Ferdinand's sister Mary. Thus, if Louis were to die without issue, the empire would be extended to the frontiers of the Slavonic world, and Charles's position vis-à-vis the Ottoman threat would be, at least to some degree, strengthened. Even so, his life involved almost constant travelling, and travelling in the early 16th century, even if one was an emperor, was an uncomfortable and exhausting business. Backwards and forwards he went, principally between Spain and the Low Countries, but also to Italy, France, England, and even North Africa. He travelled up and down the Rhine, through Württemberg, Bavaria, and Austria. All in all, he probably spent several years of his life on the road, and several months at sea. Soon after his election, his vast dominions were still further increased. In the space of a single decade, Hernán Cortés defeated the Aztec Empire of Mexico, and Francisco Pizarro, the Inca Emperor of Peru. Within a year or two, Spanish galleons were bringing untold wealth back across the Atlantic. These successes, combined with Ferdinand Magellan's circumnavigation of the world in 1522, Magellan was Portuguese, but Charles had provided all five of his ships and most of the finance, left the emperor in no doubt about his destiny. It was clear that he had been divinely ordained to be the leader of Christendom. Charles's election as emperor brought Spain into the heart of Europe. Spanish soldiers were henceforth to fight in Europe and the Netherlands. Spanish writers and philosophers imbued themselves with the new humanism of Erasmus and his followers. At the same time, Spain was acutely conscious of being the one firm rock of the true faith, its chief defence against the vile Protestant heresies springing up in the north. The election also, and this was perhaps still more important, resulted in the polarisation of continental Europe. France was now trapped, as in a vice, virtually encircled by the empire. Conversely, Charles found himself sovereign of a divided dominion, its two parts cut off from each other by a hostile state between them. The result was inevitable, a lifelong struggle between the two men for dominance in Europe and mastery of the Western Mediterranean. The new emperor had two principal ambitions. The first involved the Duchy of Burgundy. By the accession in 1467 of Charles the Bold, the last of its four great dukes. They were Philip the Bold, Le Hardy, 1363-1404, John the Fearless, Saint Peur, 1404-19, Philip the Good, Le Bon, 1419-67, and Charles the Bold, Le Téméraire, 1467-77. Burgundy had become, with Venice, the most powerful state on the continent of Europe. True, the Duke was a vassal who owed homage to the King of France for his traditional duchy, together with Flanders and Artois, and to the Emperor for the remainder. But his court was more splendid than either of theirs, and when his contemporaries called him the Grand Duke of the West, it seemed no more than his due. Duke Charles, however, though undoubtedly bold, had also been dangerously overambitious. He had foolishly set himself up against France, at whose hands he had suffered a whole series of defeats before being killed at the Battle of Nancy in 1477. Most of his lands had subsequently reverted to the French crown. The emperor, as the grandson of Mary of Burgundy and great-grandson of Charles the Bold, was deeply conscious of his Burgundian blood and was determined to restore the duchy to what it had been only a quarter of a century before his birth, serving also as an invaluable buffer state between France and Germany. As late as 1548, we find him, in his political testament, charging his son Philip never to abandon the claim to Nuestra Patria, our country. His second ambition was still only a dream, yet it was a dream that he believed might easily come to pass. He longed to win back the ancient empire of the East. Old men were still alive who remembered that dreadful day in 1453, when Constantinople had fallen to the young Sultan Mehmed II, and the Byzantine Empire, after more than 11 centuries, had come to an end. Throughout Western Europe the defeat still rankled. As early as 1396, in an effort to save the already doomed city, Charles's great-great-great-grandfather John the Fearless had been captured when a Christian army estimated at 100,000, the largest ever launched against the infidel, was smashed by Sultan Bayezid I at Nicopolis on the Danube. And in the much more recent past, had not his rival Francis, while canvassing for the imperial election, declared that if he were successful, then within 3 years he would be either dead or in Constantinople? Sultan Suleiman was a formidable warrior indeed, but against the combined forces of the Christian West, there was no reason to think that he was invincible. The difficulty was, as Charles well knew, that comparative military strength was not really the point. In Spain, thanks to the long years of Muslim occupation, men could still talk seriously of launching a crusade. In northern Europe, they knew in their hearts that it was out of the question. Crusades belonged to the long-ago days of feudal Europe. Now that the continent had become divided into individual nations and states, and in particular with the Reformation threatening to divide it even further, the sort of political unity necessary for such vast expeditions was no longer possible. For that very reason, the question was never put to the test. Charles remained preoccupied with the affairs of Europe and the religious disputes by which, as a deeply pious Christian, he was obsessed. As a result, emperor and sultan were never to confront each other. Charles would never enter Constantinople. Suleiman would never occupy Vienna or Rome. Was Charles interested in women? Not, certainly, as Francis was, or even Henry. Suleiman, for obvious reasons, was in a class by himself. He worked too hard, he travelled too much, and, while she lived, he loved his frail and beautiful Portuguese wife Isabella to distraction. Of his four illegitimate children, three were born well before his marriage. The fourth, who was to achieve fame as Don John of Austria, hero of the Battle of Lepanto, was born to a singer named Barbara Blomberg on his father's own birthday, 24th of February 1547, 8 years after Isabella's death. Charles was the only one of our four princes to abdicate. He did so piecemeal, Naples and Sicily first, then the Netherlands, and finally Spain. Physically and mentally exhausted and tortured by gout, he withdrew to the monastery of Yuste in Extremadura, where, on the 21st of September 1558, he died of malaria. The Sultan was sitting on a very low couch, covered in carpets and cushions of exquisite workmanship. His bow and arrows lay next to him. We gestured to kiss his hand and were led along a wall which faced east, being careful never to turn our backs on him. There were high-ranking officers, troops of the Imperial Guard, Sipahi, cavalrymen, and janissaries in the room. Look now at the immense sea of turbans with countless folds of the whitest silk, the bright clothes of every kind and colour, and everywhere the glitter of gold, silver, silk, and satin. Words cannot give a clear impression of that strange spectacle. Never have I seen a more beautiful ceremony. What most struck me about that crowd was its silence and discipline. The janissaries, lined up apart from the other troops, were so still that I wondered whether they were soldiers or statues until I greeted them, as I had been advised, and they all bowed their heads to me. Thus does the Archduke Ferdinand's ambassador to the sublime port, Ghislain de Busbecq, describe the court of the last, arguably the greatest and unquestionably the richest member of our quartet. The Ottoman Sultan Suleiman, normally known to us as the Magnificent, stands a little apart from the other three. To begin with, he was a Muslim, and in consequence, sublimely unconcerned with the Church of Rome. His people, the Turks, were comparative newcomers to the land that now bears their name. The first wave of Turkish invaders, the Seljuks, had burst into Asia Minor only in 1071. The Byzantine Emperor Romanus IV Diogenes had personally led an army against them, but had been soundly defeated and taken prisoner at the Battle of Manzikert in the same year. The Seljuk leader, Alp Arslan, whose moustaches, we are told, were so long that he had to have them tied behind his back while hunting, had treated him handsomely and sent him back with an escort to Constantinople, but the damage had been done. By the end of the century, the Turks had spread all over Anatolia, leaving only parts of the coast in Byzantine hands. The Seljuks left behind them an extraordinary architectural heritage, much of which still survives. Superb mosques, bridges of soaring grace and elegance, and magnificent caravanserais, one every 20 miles along the main caravan routes. But as rulers they did not last long, their army being effectively destroyed by the Mongols in 1243. During the years of confusion that followed, a number of small Turkoman states, some of them hardly larger than the tribes they represented, rose from the ruins. Among them was that of a young warrior named Otman, or Osman, who, after a whirlwind campaign, had declared his independence as ruler in the ancient Bithynia, at the extreme western end of Anatolia. In 1354, his grandson, Suleiman Pasha never became sultan, as he died before his father, crossed the Dardanelles to capture the fortress of Gallipoli, the first Turkish base on European soil. Almost at once, the Ottomans, as they had come to be called, began their relentless progress, at the culmination of which, almost exactly a century later, on the 29th of May, 1453, it was a Tuesday, the 21-year-old Mehmet II, after one of the great sieges of history, rode in triumph into Constantinople. Suleiman was Mehmet's great-grandson. He was born a few weeks after Francis, probably on the 6th of November, 1494, in Trebizond, the modern Trabzon, on the Black Sea. It was under him that the Ottoman Empire, that was to continue for another 3.5 centuries, reached the apogee of its political, military, and economic power. By the time of his death, he ruled over much of Eastern Europe and the Middle East, together with North Africa as far west as Algeria, while his navy dominated most of the Mediterranean, the Red Sea, and the Persian Gulf. To Henry of England, he was usually too remote to be of much serious concern. To both Francis and Charles, however, his ever-threatening shadow loomed immense throughout their reigns. There are, so far as we know, no portraits of him taken from life. But we possess several descriptions, largely by Venetians, which enabled Albrecht Dürer to draw and Titian to paint his portrait.